Welcome to this month's edition of Rise Up Radio. It's the June edition, and this time we're coming straight from the JB Spray. I'm going to introduce everybody, and they're going to introduce themselves. I'm Dom.
I'm Jax.
I'm Angela Bassett.
I'm Betty Davis.
I am Carol Lombe.
I'm Tim Mann.
Deborah Winger.
Okay, the music was at the folk day thing. They had it
World Funk
Folk Dance Day at the Sumac, but they had it earlier the month, and all the music you'll hear on this show is from that. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to talk to Squat Lobster, who are the people, the group, the collective, who have taken over the JB Spray building. So when, why, how, any of you?
When? Sunday, Thursday slash Sunday.
Thursday night first.
Preliminary on Thursday, back in on Sunday. Why?
Well,
housing.
Housing does sort of many. There's many empty buildings in Nottingham. Why does the JB Spray hold a sort of particular value?
Been in it before, and therefore, as a result, know that we know the owner, and we think it's unlikely that it'd be violent. Basically, which I think is a very sensible thing to think about when you're thinking about where to squat. A lot of people suggest doing the council because they're like squatting council buildings and stuff like that, and I think that's generally a good strategy to follow. It just so happens that this building is one that, although it's not owned by the council, we're still fairly sure that the owner, being a bit of a wacky Christian, is unlikely to use violence to evict us, which is it's just an important thing. It's also just an incredible building, and we've been in it before, and we know our way around, so it's, basically.
And it's been a couple of days now, and the place is sort of taking a bit more sort of cleanliness, becoming a bit more like a home. So have you got any sort of short-term plans to do?
Number one on the list is build a shitter, I think.
Yeah, like at the moment. Yeah, like plumbing's limited, so, yeah.
Like, we just want to get as many people as possible here and just get people visiting so they know it's available.
We're doing a very good job of being, like, low-key. I think the owners probably don't know we're here at the moment, which is really good because we've made it a long way. We've got, you know, quite a lot of furniture, places to sleep and stuff like that, and we've done all that really, really low-key, so, yeah. Basically, yeah, like build a shitter is one. We don't have running water here yet, which would be, though there is water running through the building, we just need to turn it on and get it to where we want it, and that's a little bit of plumbing. And then yeah, there's no electricity at the moment, so yeah, just kind of addressing all of the needs that we'd normally use electricity for, maybe get some batteries in and stuff like that. So
if people have batteries, if people have plumbing skills, if people want to do a little bit of electricity work, they should come.
Yeah, that'd be absolutely incredible. And like, if people should pop by, you'll find a very relaxed atmosphere. There's no real stress or pressure here, so yeah, no urgency. But like, if people want to pop by, that'd be absolutely incredible.
If you want to get in touch by email, you can email jubsquat@gmail.com.
Well, so there you go, you can do that. So that those has everybody here, some people here haven't squatted before, so what have been their experiences been?
Mine have been really, really good. Yeah, I really enjoyed getting in. Was quite fun, but interesting. A lot of climbing involved, but yeah, it's been really nice, and we've had absolutely no trouble at all, so it's been completely chilled out.
I mean, obviously, Nottingham has had some squatting in its past, not as much as other cities. Why do people think it's sort of important to try and develop a squatting culture within this city at the moment?
I mean, there are other ways to occupy buildings, but there are so many empty buildings, it seems that other ways aren't working at the moment. And you know, any walk you take through the town, you see really good quality buildings, interesting buildings, buildings with bits of land attached to them, buildings with playgrounds attached to them, schools, huts, flats, houses, mansions, and they're all empty. And so it's good quality housing stock. It's not being used, so it's good that squatting happens.
If I could talk a little bit about this building, it might give you a bit of an indication. Like, this building was bought by somebody who, by, from what I understand, made a lot of money in the City of London. God told him to buy this building, and then pretty much since then he hasn't really done anything with it. And it's a major building in the centre of Radford, so it's like an empty building right in the centre of the community. It's in the way and it's empty, and yeah, like, that's how capitalism works. Like, some guy who happens to make a load of money in a place which is full of money, like London, comes to Radford and they can buy up a huge big chunk of the community and do nothing with it. And actually, because, like, the guy isn't necessarily of fantastic, like, he hasn't got all his wits about him, like, the building is just rotting. He's not making any money out of it at all. And, like, yeah, that's how my attitude is, that has how capitalism works. Like, it allows people with money to own stuff even if they have no intention of using it sensibly. And there's no plan for this building. We've squatted, like, our community has squatted it 3 or 4 times before. And, yeah, like, we have to have a better way of allocating resources than just giving it to people who just happen to have vast quantities of money.
Like, you kind of mentioned two communities, two fairly, at times, distinct communities, but hopefully that's a bridge that's changing. We've got the Radford community, which is kind of broken down into students and people who certainly aren't students, and then you've got this, the community from which the squatters come. How do you think squatting here can sort of bridge that gap and help help the Radford community?
I think it's important to say that there's precedent for this. There's the ASBO, which for a very long time was, I can just see it just over there looking out the window, and although that's now stopped as a project, like, and it had its flaws and its problems towards the end and stuff, for a very long time that provided a space which whilst it housed like more of the kind of activist type community, as well as other communities like international communities and stuff like that, it provided a space that was accessible to the local community, which was really, really positive. And I think it's really important to bridge all of those gaps, but it is really hard to make connections outside of your normal framework, your safety zone or whatever, like, but I think it's really important to do that. And there's no such thing as the public or whatever in any situation. Like, the community of Radford is made up of these different pockets and loads of individuals from loads of different backgrounds. But we want to be a community. We need, if we're going to survive and flourish, we've got to be part of a community, and it's important to break those boundaries down. A squatted space is a perfect opportunity to do that. Whether everyone succeeds in that, I don't know. Like, you know, it's hard to say whether that would happen. But, like, it's a perfect opportunity because it's a space which you can take risks, you can open up, be open, be welcoming, and make links and stuff, and try and collaborate with people you don't really know so much. I think it's definitely worth. Yeah, and it's totally important to do that. It's really, really hard to say. I mean, like, it would happen by openness and confidence and, like, meeting people and stuff. And I think the ASBO was very successful to an extent, and, you know, it's obvious that there was more that could be achieved as well. I mean, Jacques could talk a little bit about that, having maybe seen it.
They all sound like great things, and I've got an inkling of some of the things that have gone in the JB Spray at its previous incarnations as a squatting location. I know a couple of you have had some experiences with JB Spray back in the past. Do you maybe want to discuss that a little bit? So talk about some of the things that went on.
Well, the first time I was involved here, like, everything was a bit rushed because we knew we had a very short period of time here, but we very, very quickly cleared out, within a couple of days, like, cleared out the whole space, And one of our first aims was to put on a community meal and run this place as a cafe in the ground floor, and we did that. And then we also had like a couple of other events and stuff, like a gig, like just acoustic gigs in the space that's available here, and just tried to make it available for people to use. All of this, everything had to happen very, very quickly, because we knew we had a limited amount of time here, because we knew that the owner was trying to kick us out. Although the owner himself was talking about trying to achieve these things. Part of our motivation to the owner of the things that we did were the things that he had said he wanted to do with the building. So we spoke to him. We'd heard what he'd been talking about in the community, and we put those things on, and we made them happen very quickly, and we did them in a very tidy fashion. Like, our community has got a strong history of achieving those kind of things on even bigger scales than this. So we had the cafe space, like just free public meals for people to come and eat, and like music gigs as well as providing, making the space available for other people to use, so people came in and like use the spaces for like dance workshops and stuff like that, which was really, really positive. And at the same time, even though we had it for a short period of time, trying to use it for housing in that short period of time as well, making it available to contacts that we knew, people that needed somewhere to stay, and trying to achieve all of those things very, very quickly. When you're squatting, you have to do things immediately, you have to do them now, because there might not be a 2 weeks' time. So you have to kind of make things happen in the moment. So, yeah, which I think is really, really important. Those are the kind of things that we achieved. And, like, if you go onto Nottingham Indie Media and, like, on the internet and look for the JB Spray Building, you'll see some of the events that happened here the last time we were here. Yeah. Okay. I'm quite proud of them. I think they were really, really successful out of a very short period of time, basically.
Okay.
Spring into action as well was... as been said, this building has been squatted two or three times before, possibly more. But there was also a week or a short week of workshops on sort of low tech living. Yeah, a week of workshops, environmental workshops, and practical workshops, and all sorts of things here. There was a photo exhibition, of course. Also from that week, there was also an action that came out of that had quite a big impact.
Okay, that's all great. And probably the best thing for people to do is they can either come down, get involved, they can send an email to
jbsquat@gmail.com.
Or they could pray to God to tell the owner of this building to let us stay as long as we want. Yeah.
dance day. Well, put on a, the folk dance day was a day at the Sumac where lots of people came and danced, but I guess, which is kind of fairly obvious, and they got the music in that I think you're going to play in the rest of the show. But the reason that the folk dance day came out of the after the there was a meeting in Forest Field called by the police in relation to social issues that people had in Forest Field, and I came away from the meeting realizing that all these people were looking to the police and looking to councillors to sort out the problems, as opposed to looking for ways that they could potentially sort out the problems for themselves, which was quite an unusual experience for me coming from a meeting. I kind of wanted to do something that made people realise that they can do things for themselves, they can make their communities better for themselves. Things like authoritarian things like CCTV are not the answer, and they're not going to help what we need. If people don't respect the place where they live and don't look after it, then these problems aren't going to go away. So the Forest Fields Folk Dance Day, well, it was raising money. It was a fundraiser for the Forest Fields Fund, which is a new fund set up by residents of Forest Fields, run for residents of Forest Fields. Unfortunately, it's not going to be a very big fund.
We've got money now.
I haven't quite had the figures back, but I think we raised about £500 with smoothies and food and a raffle. With any luck, that means that we should be able to fund a few projects. Probably not more than £100, but I mean some of the ideas that people have had so far are maybe to have some street parties. There's a website which is streetparty.org.uk, which has got lots of interesting ideas on how to start a street party. The idea is that they're community initiatives that create, I'm using the word community a lot, but create cohesion between local residents and people who live near each other and next to each other who might not necessarily know each other. Yeah. If you go to forestfields.org.uk, you can then click on the link to, I think it's /Forest Fields Fund, but I'm not entirely sure yet. But you can click on the link there, and you can also email us through that website with your proposal for an idea. So if you've got an idea, maybe you just want to do a cake stall on your local street on a Saturday, and that's fine. And maybe you need some money for a banner or for something like that. And that's what we've got money for. We don't have big money, but we do have money to help people out. So just send us an email of your idea, and I think the criteria should all be on forestfields.org.uk. If it fits our criteria, or if it fits the, well, the criteria on there.
Stringent then, criteria.
Very stringent. If it's not grassroots, you ain't doing it. Have a look and see what you can do, and let's make Forest Fields a wonderful place to live without the use of the police or CCTV or other unnecessary authoritarian measures.
Whoa, sorry. Sorry, it's pretty dangerous business. Okay, so I'll hand over the press. So, melon, ginger, lemon, lime, oranges.
Sure. We don't need the tin peaches.
We've got bananas in there already. We've got some secret skipped ingredients as well, if you require.
None of this is skipped. This is all.
This is all purchased.
All right.
Some of
now
it.
How much should I do?
I can about about half of that jug.
Yeah.
Yeah, like most of that fruit in there.
All right.
I'll go and get some of the tunes.
Yeah, Mark. When I got home, I was covered when he went home.
You've got to at least leave it until we end.
say rise up.
Bah.
Radical Roots is a network providing information and help for people setting up co-ops to provide housing for themselves or for self-managed working environments with what are called workers' co-ops. They've been going since 1988, and on the 23rd of May, they celebrated their 21st birthday by hosting a conference on economics at London's Conway Hall. Radical Roots, Donald O'Driscoll, spoke of how people had confidence investing in Radical Roots co-ops because of the experience and commitment within the network to supporting groups working for radical social change. Because people need their housing or working environments to be stable, co-ops using existing structures need to be sustainable financially as well as environmentally. The will and confidence within the network to jump through the bureaucratic hoops, combined with a consistent sharing of the knowledge people have gained in setting up co-ops, with business plans for example, has led Radical Roots for its first 20 years without a single default on payments on the loans it has made to co-ops. This makes Radical Roots' financial cooperative arm or lender, Rootstock, a reliable as well as an ethical place for people to put their money. Practical Economics, Radical Alternatives to a Failed Economic System, was the first conference of its kind. Around 200 people attended through the day, the afternoon of which consisted workshops including the New Economics Foundation on Sustainable Community Economics and Chris Cook of Open Capital on Innovative Legal Structures and Financing. Some of the afternoon's discussions centred on bringing mainstream capital back into the grassroots to give poorer people access to resources. Chris Cook also spoke of new economics being about communities working with and identifying the capital within them, be it the emotional capital of personal support, the produce of communally worked land, or products of workers' cooperatives. Saying, this is what we have, what use is it to us, what use is it to our neighbour, and if we want to trade, what value is it to those we want to trade with? The conference was a reminder that effective and sustained grassroots organising really does bring people power. A booklet is to follow the conference, so have a look at radicalroots.org.uk for news on that. But we at Rise Up Radio did get some audio from the conference, and it is definitely worth a listen. Have a listen to the clip from the workshop with Glenn and Matthew from Marsh Farm in Luton. Marsh Farm appeared to have retaken control of their lives. One of the steps to their positive story was working out just how much money came into the hands of its 4,000 or so residents. It was loads. So exactly what was going on to make it such a poor area?
So my background was one of being a little red, a little, you know, commie, as you would call them, because I was a union activist and all that. And I went through what was a distressing experience in lots of ways, because the government, the Thatcher government, hammered the trade union movement, as, and that was virtue of our own internal sellouts, if you like. You know, the structures were hierarchical in the trade union movement, and at the top of it you've got union barons, and they've got a lot more in common with Thatcher than they had with me. So it all turned out to be a big disillusionment, and if it wasn't for Exodus Collective, because I then began a period of long-term unemployment, crime, you know, that I felt that was my only option, and I didn't worry about that, you know what I mean, I felt. But then I got to a point where I thought, wow, I'm better than that too. I felt like a trap. That all, everyone I knew who had rebellious energy in them was in the knocking gear out or something. But here's what I wanted to offer for discussion for now. If you imagine the UK being a grid with lots of little squares, and each of those squares is, say, 4,000 households big. If you broke the UK down into that kind of scale, so every out town of Luton, 108,000 people, 80,000 houses, would be cut down into so many blocks of 4,000, that would be 20 blocks. Now, if in one of those blocks, Marsh Farm, let's say, we can affect change in a way that we end up with all of the things that the revolutionaries who wanted to storm the Bastille were after. Common ownership of the means of production, distribution and exchange, for example. Take that down to an estate level rather than state level. Yeah? State provision, good idea on paper, in practice, bureaucratic, monolith, corruption, self-interest, all of that. Take it down to estate level and have the same structures. We looked at our estate and what's our GDP, what's our gross domestic product, what's our annual money coming into Marsh Farm in public and private, and where does it go? When you look at that, like 4,000 houses, we found out it's just under 100 million coming in every year, and we spend it here, there. Social services on our estate, our share of the townwide budget, 3.4 million a year. Now I'm telling you, if we had 3.4 million a year on the estate to deal with the social issues, there wouldn't be any. And that's the truth. Because little bits of money before tragedy happens is the answer. But the system is reactive. It spends billions on bureaucrats and officers and all these administrators and all that. And the actual frontline people can't do the job. So we recognise that if you can change in one of those grid squares, an example being, if we were able to end up by this time in 5 years' time, where the primary purchase of tea on our estate was just changed tea, which is an ethical trading connection we've made with some squatters in India. They squatted a tea plantation, grew their own tea, we buy it from the tons and distribute it, so it cuts out the middleman. If we were able to make that, because when we did it, we surveyed the estate, what tea do you drink? Pigeon Tips, Tetley, Yorkshire, 60% of that, 40%. If in 5 years' time, 70% of people said, I drink just changed tea, so there was an ethicalised arrangement, then that particular Babylonian industry has gone to a large degree from Marsh Farm. Primarily it's a sharing and cooperation based trading arrangement. Do you see what I'm saying? Right, if you manage to do it with your tea, and then through credit unions and community banking, you manage to do it, or post office banking even, you know, publicly owned banking, we manage that in 5 years' time, virtually no one banked with Barclays anymore, because there was a better banking arrangement. If in 5 years' time, our GDP, instead of rushing off the estate paying external contractors, could be paid internally because we had the capacity we released. I don't like the term capacity building, I prefer capacity releasing because it's in communities already and needs unleashing. If we were able to do all those things and lock in some of that wealth that currently floods out, setting up social enterprises and capturing some of that spend that's made outside, and then crucially, those enterprises are owned by the whole community. I'd argue with anybody in here that the means of production, distribution and exchange, banking, and Marsh Farm have taken a turn for the spiritual better, if you like, because they're now not for private profit. And on top of that, if those industries, those enterprises, are not hierarchically shaped in their management structures. And when you've got a concrete example, self-managed, so everybody is no longer a mental captive to authority, if you like, that's a much healthier estate. And then you'll see depression, anxiety, exclusion, all of those things would fold away over a period of time. I'm convinced of that. We've seen evidence of it already on Marsh Farms in terms of increased participation, happiness, community longing, so we've got all of that. And then the estate next to us, they too have £93 million a year going through their estate of 4,000 people. And it would be like a light going on in a dark place. And people like us, because there's us in every community, there's people in every community just like us, doesn't take a lot of your idea to mobilising your community. With an inspirational example, then people could make their own way, in their own way, according to their own community, and reclaim their shops and banks and etc.
For the full audio from that workshop, go to the audio extras section from the archives menu, or just look at the bottom of the front page of the website.
Marsh Farm was really good. You have to stress how exciting it was. That guy was amazing.
Well, we at Rise Up Radio highly recommend that you listen to the full audio from the workshop with the Marsh Farm guys.
Because maybe you'll get excited as we did.
Now for some more music from the Folk Dance Day from Baba Ganoushka.
walking down Threadneedle Street one day, when I saw a guy in considerable disarray. Atop a 20-story tower block, he was clearly a high ranker. I calls up to him and says, "Excuse me, mate, are you a merchant banker?" He says, "Oh, I sin most mortally, oh yay, oh yay. I seek redemption for the terrible errors I have made." "Don't worry, Chum," I says, "we all make mistakes, you know. Come down here and talk to us way down here below." Then from 20 stories up, he opens up his heart to me. "'Twas I that bankrupted RBS and half the country. Shareholders lost their investment and the government is thinking twice about paying me my pension, which I'm sure you would agree is not very nice." Looking up at the gleaming tower block, I could see distant reflections of derelict properties and repossession notices from end to end of the country. I saw the spectre of job centres and endless queues of factory workers queuing up for a crappy job to keep them from the clutches of Lloyd's, HBOS and cash converters. In a moment of passion, I grabbed a megaphone from a nearby copper and cried out to Sir Fred at the top in a voice that was loud but proper. With tears streaming down my face, I cried out emotionally, "Do the right thing for all of us down here in the land of the free." I said, "Jump, you fucker, jump, and put your place in a proper dimension." I said, "Jump, you fucker, jump, and save us 706,000 quid a year on your fucking pension."
So I'm in Brewer's Yard at a gathering of, what was it, lefties?
Mostly, I suppose. A few lefties and tourists.
Below the backdrop of the beautiful castle and the sandstone cliffs, blah, blah, blah. So it's May the 2nd. Why are we doing this today?
It's a lack of tradition, really, isn't there? I've come down here with my two children, and I was explaining to them what it's all about. So my five-year-old was asking me if I'm a worker, which I work, but I got her in a professional job, so I don't know if that counts me as a worker in the kind of sense of a kind of May Day celebration. There's no general kind of understanding of really kind of what it's all about, certainly not amongst kind of young people, and it's just kind of another bank holiday for most people, isn't it? Unfortunately. So, yeah, people have under the kind of impression everybody's middle class these days, and all the people who are either working class or kind of underclass are invisible, really.
Traditionally, what is it about?
So I suppose traditionally it's sort of celebration of kind of workers' rights and solidarity with workers, which really should be celebrated on May the 1st, really, rather than the nearest Monday.
Do you have any thoughts about the current political climate for workers?
It's pretty depressing, really, when there's very little sort of common sort of awareness or consciousness of what the kind of situation is for unemployed people or underpaid people.
But a growing number of unemployed.
Yeah, but pretty invisible, really. And there's... So the trade union movement doesn't really kind of do that much to defend. Yeah, they're so worried about their own jobs that they don't really kind of want to rock the boat too much to kind of defend the rights of people who are already unemployed.
Can you see any changes that we might see in this country socially through the current economic situation?
Not more really. No. Sorry to be a bit pessimistic, but not really. No, it's just, you know, I mean, without even some Yeah, I mean, the first step is having some sort of consciousness. If you haven't got that, things are just going to deteriorate more and more, even with, you know, like with Fred Goodwin. It's, you know, it's in the papers for a couple of weeks or so, and then it's all, you know, sort of go on to another sort of topic of the day. So there's no sort of ongoing kind of awareness of
real politics. Yeah, in the media. But maybe actual conditions could perhaps facilitate conscious changes in consciousness and collective consciousness through the absence of having paid jobs and things to do.
What do you mean? The kind of worse economic conditions get, the more people might be more aware, conscious.
I mean, start to do things off, you know, off their own back.
Or they just start blaming the Italians or the Polish and people of my skin colour and yeah. So
right. No. Good to talk to
yeah?
you.
Okay, yeah. Okay then. Look after yourself.
See you later.
Would you like to sign a petition against postal seller for all mail?
Against what, sorry?
Wait, I'm a postman, yeah?
Yeah.
We're campaigning against Big Spandau's support of raw mail off to a Dutch company, TNT. Postal privatisation.
Yeah, definitely.
Just stick your name and address there.
No problems.
I suppose you've heard about it, have you?
No, I haven't actually. I mean, I'm recording for Rise Up Radio. We're an independent internet-based radio. I don't know if you can tell us a bit about it.
Peter Manderson's trying to rush a bill through to privatise 30% of Royal Mail.
Okay.
One of the candidates favourable to buy 30% is TNT, Dutch-owned company. The CWU, our union, against any partial sell-off for Royal Mail because it goes against the Labour's manifesto. In their manifesto, Labour's manifesto is to keep Royal Mail 100% publicly owned company. And this branch in the Nottingham area, we've been taking it to the streets and informing the public with a petition signing, postcards to the MPs. We've got over 180 MPs already signed up back in an early day motion. I think it's early day motion number 48.
And how many Nottingham MPs have you got?
I think there's around six or seven. Alan Simpson's one of them who's signed. Vernon Coke hasn't signed because he says he can't sign because he's a minister. Jeff Hoon hasn't signed, he's a minister.
Like John Heppel.
John Heppel hasn't signed yet.
We ask everyone to join us in supporting the 12 men facing deportation as well as supporting
Kit Kamiado. We turn around Nick Palmer, he's signed. Alan Meal.
One of the really
signed.
Simple things you could do is write a letter.
And how do people find out about the campaign if they want to find out more about it?
Find me and
they can they can log on the internet.
Also donate to the Legal Friends.
www.cwu.org.
Okay.
Especially because important because Hitchhiker has been committed to work.
Yeah, yeah. Good luck with that.
And all the donations have made a huge difference.
Hi everyone.
I could just record. Yeah, maybe.
The Refugee Forum and the Anti-Deportation Group, and I've done most of my campaigning lately with Regis and the Nottingham Zimbabwe Community Network, but I think the issues around deportation affect every nationality in the same way. And at the Destitution Group, we are seeing people who would rather live in poverty and be homeless than go back to a country that is obviously dangerous for them. And if I use Zimbabwe as an example, unless you've been living in a cave for the last 10 years without a TV, everybody knows that that country has been witness to thousands of murders that have been politically motivated. Yet this government right now is forcing deportations of Zimbabwean asylum seekers back to a country where they will be knowingly murdered. And I'm going to call it murder. Our government sends individuals back to a country to be murdered. And there's no other word for it. And that's happening in other countries also. I think anti-deportation is the right move. And I would like people here to support that campaign. And today, when we're talking about money and fat cats, we're seeing people in this country milk it for every pound they can get.
And at the same time, we're seeing people in this country live on nothing, and they actually prefer that. And I hear often when people are talking about asylum seekers, they're coming over here, they're taking our jobs, they're living on all our benefits, when actually there is no right to work if you're an asylum seeker. So you live in destitution, you can't become part of the community that you want to support you. And we also have a right to work campaign, and it would be great if you could join that also. Because I know for a fact that the individuals that I deal with at the Refugee Forum want to make a contribution to this country. And if you want to talk about benefits, if you think about the Home Office and how much these individuals get paid and you actually do the maths, it costs many times more to hound these people, stick them in detention centres or fly them off to any other country than it would to support them in this country. And actually, research shows that if immigrants are allowed to work, they contribute to the economy of a country. They do not decimate it. That is right-wing propaganda. And the Refugee Forum and the Anti-Deportation Group are here to dispel those myths and say that these individuals need asylum, they should be granted asylum, they've got a contribution to make, and they should be granted the right to make that contribution. The stall's over there, make a donation, or better still, give us your time, give us your energy, and get involved. It's a human issue, it's not a race issue.
Thank you very much, Angela. And when she's talking about people scrounging, would you just remember, or the companies scrounging, the top 700 companies in Britain, one quarter of them paid absolutely no tax last year. And then these people have the right to tell people living on pitiful benefits or people denied benefits that they're taken out of the country. The last speaker in this session will be Pete Watson from the Nottinghamshire Stop the BNP campaign.
It's been a great day. It's been fantastic to see trade unionists united with all protesters that's taking place across the Nottinghamshire area. For myself, I find it a little difficult possibly to raise an inspiring speech at this time of the day. We've already had quite a lot of speakers making their points. However, I don't believe that I need to make a great deal of an inspiring speech because I know many people here are already active in opposing the British National Party. And I'd just like to make one single appeal. And that appeal is that we need to oppose the British National Party. But further than that, we need to organise in our communities. We need to organise in our trade unions. We need to organise our workplaces because there's a danger, a real danger, that the British National Party will win seats in the coming elections in June. We'll be right back.
And now we're going to talk about the BNP. European elections coming up very soon. BNP may get a few seats or fighting for a few seats. One in particular, it will be dangerous if they get one up in Lancashire. I believe Nick Griffin is running for one there. I really hope I've got that right. But sort of more locally, they've been leafleting, they've been sticking the nose in where it's not wanted in certain areas around Nottingham, including Lenton and West Bridgford.
But bloody posties delivering their leaflets, haven't they?
They have, which we can also talk about, and also talk about the strike that some of the mailers did down in London, because they refused to do that. So there's many things to talk about. I'm not sure where a good place to start is. Well, I think a perfectly good place to start it with is...
We can start with MP expenses.
Let's start with MP expenses. Okay.
Just as a suggestion.
Go for it.
Okay, so like at the moment, obviously, it's a really great thing that the MP's expenses have been all exposed, and it's turned out that actually they're all relatively useless people on the fiddle.
What?
MPs.
Really?
Yeah. It's a bit depressing, really, because I thought they were there to represent my views in Parliament. But yeah, so in this kind of atmosphere, it adds to the general kind of atmosphere of like disillusionment with mainstream politics that the BNP feeds off. And I think that coinciding with this European elections, it could be a really serious time potentially for the BNP as a prospect. So I guess that's one of the reasons why I'd be worried right at the moment. The problem with the BNP is they're not really an alternative solution unless you want fascism as your alternative, which is a pretty big step to say, oh, I'm not really up for this New Labour thing, I'll go to fascism instead. It's a big leap. British National Party, before Nick Griffin took over, they were very, very clearly totalitarian fascist organisation coming out with their roots from like the National Front and the previous extreme right organisations that existed in the in Britain before. And Nick Griffin took them on a new path of electoralism, tried to make them look like an ordinary party, which wasn't very difficult because obviously most of the mainstream parties have been looking fairly thin in their terms of their policies in recent years, so it's very easy to look like an ordinary party because you don't have to do much because they don't do much. And that's the path that Nick Griffin's taken them on. They've got rid of all the skinheads, they now dress in suits and they try to be electable, and that's where they're at. But ultimately they're still the same organisation, they still maintain like the same policies, and all the time, BNP members are coming out with these extraordinary quotes about what they think about stuff. And Nick Griffin himself has come out with all these different quotes over different times, like massively racist things, nationalistic things, and
I think like the absurdity of them is pretty obvious to a fair number of people. Do you think that maybe one of the biggest dangers is of the BNP, not that they're going to get in, not that they're going to become, well, own number 10 Downing Street, but they'll move the discourse closer and closer to them. Yeah. And therefore, the obvious racism that was in the sort of two major parties is going to creep further and further into the agenda. Is there any way, sort of, without setting up another political party to do the reverse job, that we can sort of attack that?
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly it. Like, I don't think that... It's really strange. Like, elections are really important for the BNP because they're an opportunity for them to play the game. The game that they've set out is to use elections to get their message across. And their message is all about nationalism, like racism, and everything that goes along with that. I've always thought that the elections are a really good opportunity, a really important time to get the alternative image out, make it clear what that is, what their agenda is, and leaflet against the BNP. yeah, that doesn't necessarily mean leafleting for another party. Traditionally, a lot of anti-BNP activity has been focused around leafleting for the Labour Party. I don't think that's necessary. Whilst I do think it's important to leaflet around election times, I don't think it's necessarily important to leaflet for a particular party. All I can say is, like, we've, as the community that a lot of us are from, have found many ways of being politically active, which don't involve being part of political parties, and I think we need to consider the BNP to as a threat to all of those active things that we do, all of that politics that we do. But we don't necessarily need to respond to that threat with a party of our own. I don't think that's necessary at all. We just need to make sure that we maintain our politics out there in the community. I think leafleting against the BNP is a very simple way of getting the message out there, because that's what they do. They leaflet, and if we leaflet, that's pretty good. We need to make sure that they don't have the opportunity to hold stalls. If they try and hold stalls in our communities, I think we should go and shut their stalls down. And if they ever conceive of marching on the streets, which hasn't happened so much in recent years at all, like, that was one of the things about the Nick Griffin's BNP, is they don't march. But if they ever conceive of doing that, that we need to stop them from marching and take them on head on the streets if it's needed. I think it's very easy to come up with simple solutions to what seems like a simple problem, but fascism is a very complicated issue, and I think we need to address it broadly through society in general. And one of the other issues in relation to anti-fascist stuff is a lot of sectarianism, and whilst there are reasons to have legitimate problems with some of the organisations that are involved in anti-fascist stuff, I think we need to create a broad resistance. So whilst we may not be happy working with particular organisations such as the Socialist Worker Party and other left organisations that would probably be equally as ridiculous if they came into power as the BNP, we need broad social responses to these problems and stuff. But I think it's we live in a country where fascism isn't something that's particularly tasteful to many people. At this time there's still memories of the Second World War and fighting against Nazism at the time, and it's a concept in our society that we're anti-fascist as a society anyway, and I think that's broadly positive, and we shouldn't see it as too much of an uphill struggle, and tapping into those things is really, really important. But I think really ultimately we need to, if we're going to resist fascism, we want to be pushing through our agenda with what we want society to be, a liberated society, for many of us, an anarchist society. We want to achieve that aim, want to achieve our revolution and all that kind of stuff. We need to be pushing for that, and if we follow that through, that will create a space where fascism isn't possible. But where the BNP look like they might be succeeding in their game, we really do need to fight against that. It is a really serious issue, and we shouldn't overlook it just because we don't want to form a party, we don't want to do this. It doesn't mean that we can just forget about the BNP, because their plan has worked in the past, in other countries. It might seem like deep history of 50, 60 years ago and stuff like that, but it's not all that long ago, and it's a very simple plan, and it can work very well. And we're entering a new economic phase now, and it could be a really serious time, basically. And we shouldn't neglect the possibility. I don't know. I think all I can say is, if we're going to achieve anti-fascist struggles, we probably need to collaborate with a lot of people around us and stuff like that. But that doesn't necessarily mean compromising our politics. It just means thinking in an open-minded way. Thank you.
I'm sure you'll all agree that was brilliant. And so I guess that does bring us to the end of the show. This month we're doing it in new formats. We're going to have one show which you're listening to, which is start of the month, and there'll be another show later in the month on the 15th. And we'll also be doing it live from the JB Spray. With the Lobster Squad. And in which case, I hope you'll all join us for that. In fact, I hope so many of you turn up to the recording of that that none of you want to listen to the show. And we're going to leave. Well, everybody's going to say goodbye first. Say goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Now everyone said goodbye. We're going to leave you with a track from someone whose birthday is on the day this show comes out.
Happy birthday.